My top five podcasters, Chris Lambert, and probably myself, but this ain't about that. The Mundane Festival is where you're at. If you've been tapped in, you know what's up. If you're a first timer, hey, welcome to the club. The cost of admission is simply a subscription, then rating and reviewing it wherever you listen. Don't worry about change ups, the cast won't break up. Even when that $1 million contract show up, a stand up guy who's a stand up comedian with a stance on everything from food to media. So welcome to the show, please take your seat. Let's find out what he's got in store this week. Who, me? I'm Don Will, your opening act. Thanks for coming out. Please clap. The Mundane Festival. With your host, Chris Lambert.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, August 22nd, 2021. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. And if you're really into this thing, I need you to go over to Apple Podcasts. Give this show a 5-star review. Let everybody know why you like it, because it's simply the right thing to do. And if you want to take your love and appreciation of this podcast to an even deeper level, go over to patreon.com/mundanefestival and subscribe. It's $3 a month for hours and hours and hours of bonus content. This is episode 528. I have a super special guest, journalist and author Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, ESPN, and NPR Weekend. I'm extremely excited to share that conversation that I had with him, with you, in a bit. A couple things before that. My apologies for the podcast being late. I've been really busy with stuff and things. Spent way too much money at Marshall's. I was just going in there for washcloths and spent a lot of money on some candles. Had some auditions, got one today that I got to work on. So that's been my life. But I want to get you to Howard really quick. So super excited, like I said, to share this conversation that I had with him. We recorded it over two sessions and I put them together, and we mainly talked about his two recent books, Full Dissidence, Notes from an Uneven Playing Field, and The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. And a couple more things. In the conversation, we were talking about movies towards the end, and I was trying to talk, we were talking about art house movies, and I was trying to compare one of them, this film, 9 Days, with Winston Duke and Zazie Beetz. I was trying to compare that to Soul, and I couldn't remember it, so I just called it the jazz movie that made everybody cry on Christmas Day. And that was the movie I was referring to. It's more of a grounded, it's more of a darker version than of Soul, but it's a terrific movie. And on our second conversation, towards the end, Howard referenced his T-shirt that he was wearing. He was wearing a Martin Scorsese T-shirt in the logo style of the Marvel Studios logo. And I had never seen that before, so it was really hilarious. So we were talking about Marvel movies and he referenced his shirt. And I just had a fantastic time talking to him. I'm super honored that he, how many times can I say super excited in this fucking intro? But I was honored to have him on the show. And here you go. Without further ado, here is my conversation with the incomparable Howard Bryant. A couple years ago, I went to the Calvin Theater.
I lived across the street.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in 2019, I went there to see this one of my favorite singer-songwriters, Jenny Lewis. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. But the only thing I missed out, I didn't get to eat up there. Because I planned it too late. And I had to eat at an Applebee's in Mount Holyoke or something like that.
Yeah, you didn't miss anything. The food in Northampton's not great.
Oh, okay, good. No, well, I didn't miss,
anything. I mean, the good food is, there's a couple of good restaurants in Northampton, but most of it's over in Amherst or a little further away.
No, I
lived in Northampton for 9 years. I just moved this February.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I just moved over the bridge. I live on the right off the UMass campus.
Okay, because I haven't spent much time in Boston, but I have been spent a lot of time in the Berkshires doing comedy festivals, Mass Mocha and Pittsfield.
Oh yeah, I'll be out there next week.
Oh, cool. Yeah,
it's not far. I'll be out in Williamstown. Williamstown is probably about 90 minutes from here, not even, a little less.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've been to the Williamstown Theater Festival out there.
Same.
I love it. It's fantastic.
I still wear my WTF sweatshirt and people are like, is that the podcast? I'm like, no, that's Williamstown.
Yeah. I've been a couple times and it's mainly just to see the black stuff. Not to be racist, but I've seen some really good stuff there.
That's not racist. That's smart.
Oh, I know. That's true. You're right. I'm not racist. No. I want to start with you had one of the best quotes or comments after Loki ran last month, and I want to read this, and then I'm assuming that you've seen all of the Disney Plus Marvel shows, yes or no?
All of them?
Well, just the like WandaVision, Loki, and
Falcon. Falcon. Yes. I know. Okay. What If just started. I haven't seen that because I think it's just beginning.
I think it's in a couple of days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you had this one of the best reactions to the Loki. The last black man in San Francisco is waiting for you at the end of time. I thought that was perfect because I'm an indie movie nerd. I love that movie. I thought that was one of the best movies of what
I was like. I said that. That's good. That was good.
Yeah, nope. Everybody else was like, "Well, okay, the guy from Lovecraft Country." I thought what did you think of that performance
of the movie?
Of Loki. Or we could talk about Last Black Man in San Francisco too. We could talk about all of
it. Yeah, I thought that I'm really interested in where film goes in this moment in time that we're in, as we're talking about all of these different conversations about this so-called racial reckoning, this so-called post-racial America, this so-called everything. And I think that where you start to see how time deals with these moments is through the popular culture. You're going to see it through the pop culture, through the movies, through some of the, you know, through the books, through the scholarship, all of these things. And one of the things that I saw that I was paying close attention to is this idea that you have to spoon feed people and you have to spoon feed white people a little bit of history so they don't retreat, so they don't run away. You've got to cut it up into little pieces and, you know, it's like giving them, you know, oatmeal without sugar. You got to put some sugar and you got to put some berries and shit in it to make sure that they'll pay attention. And, you know, and when you look at these movies, when you look at Last Black Man in San Francisco, when you look at Sorry to Bother You, when you look at Lovecraft Country, you look at all of these different programs and projects that are out there, you look at Watchmen, all of these things, you're sprinkling Black history into science fiction. Mm-hmm. You look at Us and you look at Get Out and the same, all of these movies and all these projects have a similar theme, which is, you're taking a real issue of Black history and you're trying to give it some sort of entertainment value, because if you just gave it to them in straight documentary, they wouldn't watch it.
Right.
So I thought Last Black Man in San Francisco was such a terrific movie in a lot of ways. And it was so understated and it was so over the top at the same time. I thought that the environmental racism in that movie was fantastic when you're looking at the fish with the three eyes and everything else, and you're thinking about the number of people who have flushed their contact lenses down the toilet and all of that stuff, and you're seeing what the effect is on people.
Right.
And I thought it was especially good that it was in San Francisco, because people don't think about San Francisco as the racist place that it is, because they think that if your values are good, then somehow you're not, you know, you're not committing harm. You know, you're not doing people wrong. And anybody black who's ever been in San Francisco is like, where are all the black people at? You got to go out to Hunter's Point to go find them. You got to go out to Ingleside. You got to go out and learn a little bit about that history, the racial history of that city. Mm-hmm. And so it was, and having lived out there for 10 years, of course, I was very much immersed in it, but it was really, really well done. And it was so well done. You always know when a movie's good when 3-4 days later, and then 2 weeks later, you start thinking about new things. Yes. Or you're continuously concentrating on how the movie was put together and what it meant to you and all the things that it gave you.
It was so good. I just love like the black male friendship.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of a little bit of a more grounded version of Be Kind, Rewind in a lot of ways when dealing with community and yep. what it means, like these denizens of that area in San Francisco. And it was just a really sweet movie.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. And it was it's an A24 movie. So I'm kind of a label whore when it comes to like indie art house movie, like A24. Yep. Really puts their stamp on stuff.
Same. So. I'm a huge fan. I thought they're so good. I thought they were foreign. They're from New York. They're American.
Yeah. And it's just like, okay, A24, this studio, it's got to have something. Cause I noticed like the nerd in me, it's almost like I wanted to roll my eyes in the opening shots, but I was like, yeah, I'm going to like this movie, but yeah. I see what you're doing. But yeah.
And they did a great job. And also, once again, if you know anything about San Francisco, or if you've been there or spent any real time in San Francisco, the way they handled that architecture mm-hmm. and the way they handled that sort of backstory of the house and yes. of this idea of ownership. And they really did have you believe in that, you know, that the story made sense. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that there was some sort of ownership and some sort of theft and some sort of, and in a way there was, because of the lack of accessibility you have to those types of properties, that you're never part of this, right? That this right. is, that the real message in that film to me in a lot of ways was, there's so much that you feel belongs to you by being there that couldn't be more distant from you.
Yeah, I spent about a week out there in 2013 doing stand up at Cobb's Comedy Club.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my closest friends since first grade had moved out there. He had been out there a couple of years and he took me around. But we just kind of went around the Mission and the Hate a little bit. And
my neighborhood.
OK, yeah. And it's mm-hmm. it's a beautiful city. But yeah, you do kind of wonder, like, are all the black people the ball players or what's going on here? And you there the homelessness there, and I think like Barry Jenkins to me is a genius, but the nerd in me, the hipster in me, will always go to Medicine for Melancholy to be my favorite of his.
Yeah
because it was just black people living in present day dealing with complicated black people living in present day society. And it was just like it was just a really good film.
No, that's right. And I think that's one of the things that I thought that Us did really well as well. I think Jordan Peele did a great job of that, where if you're paying attention to some of the messages in the movie, mm-hmm. essentially what I took from that was, it's not an accident that you had Last Black Men in San Francisco and you had Us coming out right around the same time, both being set in the Bay Area. Because this is the place where your wealth inequality is going to destroy you. Mm. This is the place where you look at all the homeless encampments, you look at all the tents, you look at the gaps between what you can afford and, you know, and what it was, what it used to be.
Right.
And I thought that it was no accident, or if it was an accident, it was one of those beautiful accidents where this beautiful place is the epicenter of the type of disparities that tear societies apart.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it reading, like I read Full Dissonance before I read the heritage, and I read the heritage last week, and I couldn't help but not only just having Paul Robeson in at the beginning and being in through line throughout the whole book, I couldn't help but not make those parallels to entertainment, like show business. Although sports is entertainment, but just show business, like with regards to stand up and acting. I mean, just a little background on me, like in my circle of Black comedian friends, the question is always like, am I a coon? Like, you don't want to be a coon. And the measuring stick for me, at least one of them, is middle-aged to elderly Black people, when they come to a show, that they approve, that they give me the thumbs up. I'm not lying to you. So I read Full Dissidence a couple of weeks ago when I was doing some shows in Atlantic City at the Borgata. And because of COVID, you really don't shake people's hands after the show. And so I left after my set to get something to eat. And I'm just walking back to my hotel in the resort. And these two black couple, man and woman, about 60 years old, they were like, good job. Good show, you had a good set. And I was like, I did it, I'm great.
I mean, I am laughing. You're not even really saying anything funny. And if you're wondering why I'm laughing so hard, if you're wondering about this disconnect right now, you're like, why am I cracking up when you're giving me actually a good story? It's because it reminds me of my aunt and my uncle. Like, we had this exact same thing, right? 15 years ago. Somewhere in there, 2005, 2006, somewhere in there. My aunt and uncle came over, and this was right around Chappelle's Show second season, right before the third season that never happened, right? And we're sitting there, me and my boys, we're sitting there cracking up. And my aunt just sat there stone-faced. I mean, stone-faced, to your point, right? And it was like she was looking at a funeral. She was not laughing. And she just looked at me and she said, this is the same type of humor that white people made. It's just that somebody Black's making the money now. And I was like, ow, why are you killing me? She just totally, she took the mood and just shot it down to zero. I was like, but what about the nigger family? Right? She was not having that. She wasn't having the racial draft, which I didn't think was that funny. But she was not having any of, I don't think there was a single skit in any of that DVD box set we watched that she was like even cracked a smile. So it's a high bar right there because of like who is deciding. Well, one, comedy, I do not envy any of you guys for what you do because it's such a subjective medium in the first place. It's the hardest thing on earth to do, you know, and especially when you start adding the Black side to it as well about what's funny, what's not, what holds, what doesn't. And that is the, you know, I know what you mean when you get that approval from the elders, you're like, okay,
yeah,
all right, I'm good. And look at Chappelle. I mean, that was the same thing with him, right? It's like, well, wait a minute. You were the one making this, you know, you were the one making this accessible to white people, walking up and dropping the N-word on you. It's like, that's a really fine line. On the one hand, it's your humor, but on the other hand, in the wrong hands, what happens to your humor?
That's the thing. And it's something that I think about. It's not just because these elderly Black people like my work. Doesn't mean I don't have more work to do. I obviously do, but it's just like, that is the thing. Like, it's almost like it's the one thing where it's like, we're not monoliths, but at the same time, you know, you talk about it in both Full Dissidence and The Heritage. What does it mean to you, like, just pushing the ball forward, moving the baton and improving on the design and trying to do something new? One, it's that. And then it's like mom and dad surrogates at the same time. Like,
no doubt. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, it's just you kind of it's always in the back of my mind. And I'm trying to figure out how I want to say it. I don't mind it. I don't mind that there's that quote unquote struggle, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think what happens is it does go back to the similar point of what are you doing with my intentions? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you can be around the way and that humor is understood. And then you put it in a different community, you put it around white people, you put it around, and all of a sudden it changes.
Yeah.
And now, am I part of the solution in giving you the healing power of laughter, or have I cooned us? Exactly. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It all depends on in whose hands your comedy is, right? Who, yeah, what are you going yeah. to do with this power I give you? Right. And so that is it's not a small thing. It's not a small thing. And it's one of the reasons why you're always in some ways, you really do have to decide which issues you choose to take on. For example, if there is an idea that I really feel like writing about, but part of me is like, well, wait a minute, if I go too hard in on this, then the right wingers are going to think I'm an ally and I'm not your friend. Mm-hmm. So right. maybe this is an idea that I'm going to sit on for a while until I feel like I can find a way to get it to a point where there's no ambiguity about how I feel. Because you don't want to be that person who finds their work being manipulated or finds their intonations being manipulated. It's a really difficult thing.
Yeah. And I guess that's where the skill comes in, and that's what you have. I want to ask you, when did you become a full dissident? When did you realize, at least maybe I want maybe talk about that in sports wise, although sports is a microcosm of society, but maybe sports and then just regular life. And I mean that by saying, like, at least within sports, I think I realized when, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when Charlie Ward didn't get drafted by the NFL, that was mm-hmm. one of the things where I was just like,
that was one of your full D moments.
Yeah. It was like, I was 13, but it was like, yeah. this is bullshit. And there was a time, when somebody said it, a sportscast or somebody said it, there was a time in New York where Charlie Ward was the best quarterback in New York, and he was mm-hmm. playing point guard for the Knicks.
Yeah.
But they said he was too short, that he was 6'2". Doug Flutie got to play Howard. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think for me, when I think about these different moments, it's always been a constant. Mm-hmm. I think what it is, it's a navigation.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, when I sort of describe what that full D moment is for me, it really is when you decide you don't feel like navigating anymore. Mm. I'm not here to compromise with you. Like, I was on Twitter the other day and somebody made some comment about why, you know, do we have to get to this, you know, point where, you know, Obama is always trying to, you know, where Obama is always trying to make friends with everybody. And somebody stepped in and said, I don't know about that. Where's the evidence of that? And I was like, where is there not the evidence of that? I was like, you know, if I hear the phrase our common creed one more time, while we're being demolished in this country, it's, you know, I mean, this is part of the negotiation.
Right.
So for me, I think it was more, you know, when you are in an integrated society, which is not integrated, it's essentially, there's the few of us who make it. There's a few of us who get to be in those spaces. Whether that's a positive or a negative. You spend most of your time trying to figure out how to navigate this thing. How do I navigate this? How do I find comfort or space being the only Black person in this room, or the only Black person at that dinner, or the only, you know, or the number of times I'm called articulate, or the number of times I have to navigate code, you know, the number of times I have to hear about somebody who plays the game the right way and then somebody who doesn't play the game the right way, and all of these different things. And so from a sports standpoint, you deal with it constantly. You're constantly dealing with it because sports is laden with the cliches, and like, right. there's nothing but code in sports. Mm-hmm. And sports is also the place where it tries to tell you it's a meritocracy when really it's nothing but code. It's the exact opposite of a meritocracy. The only meritocracy that you have in sports is when Black people excel. Because when you have two athletes of similar quality or two coaching candidates of similar quality, we know who's going to get the job.
Yeah.
Right? So the only time that there's a true meritocracy in sports, it's when you know the Black person is so far superior that there's no point trying to scout anybody else out, right? Like, I always ask myself the question, are we really saying that there's not a single white person in a planet of 7 billion that can play cornerback in the NFL? Who was the last starting white cornerback in the NFL? Regular? I'm not talking about a guy Seahorn. Who played. It's got to be Jason Seahorn, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's 13 years ago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like one of the things that gets me is that I am so tired of, you know, especially post George Floyd and this George Floyd economy where suddenly our phones ring. Mm. And it's like, this person is the first black person to do, and it's really pedestrian shit.
Yeah.
You know, right. When really all you're saying is you're the first black person they hired. You're not the first black person. Like, if you want to give me somebody who's the first black anything, give me the first black person who could do something that nobody black could do in the past, then that's special. So right. So if you hit me with the first white cornerback, okay, that's important, right? Because yeah. if I see a white cornerback or a white running back, and I'm not talking about a fullback, I'm talking about a tailback. Mm-hmm. There are certain positions in the NFL that you just aren't getting.
Right.
And you know, those are special positions, but the rest of this, I'm like, you're really just exposing yourself, and shame on the black people out there who are like, hey, I'm the first black person. Really?
Yeah.
You're just who they hired.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing because it's like, sports is so embedded in our DNA that when people, you know, when Kaepernick, you know, at the height of it, people, I'm going boycott. I had friends that are super righteous and I love them to death because they challenge me. They challenge me and it makes me a better person, but it's like, you know, I'd like to know who, you know, what kept me in, you know, what kept me in. Okay. So when I was about 23, 10 years after Charlie Ward didn't get drafted, maybe we're talking Maurice Clarett, the rise of Maurice Clarett.
97?
Maurice Clarett was 02
later. Okay.
Yeah. When, you know, he was trying to go pro and they wouldn't let him and they, you know, and then he had, you know, his issues. Some of it was self-inflicted, but I kind of blame the league a little bit. But that's when I was just like, I'm kind of done with college football.
Yeah.
I just don't care. Yeah. Like I'll root for the black quarterbacks. And that's what's kept me in. Like black quarterbacks has kept me in. I remember I had a coworker fall out on the floor almost when he said, with regards to Patrick Mahomes, he said, hey, you know, the Chiefs, they got a black quarterback. I was like, what? They do? And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, his dad. Yep. I was like, that's my team now. I guess I'm rooting for him. And he fell out on the floor laughing. But that's what's kept me in. I've written about that on stage. I would like to tell you off mic, but it's like, I guess that's just been my end with the NFL. That's the only thing I care about now.
Yeah, it is real interesting when you decide what is going to be the connection. I mean, mm-hmm. The connections used to be organic, but you know, you reach a certain age where it's like there are other things happening.
Yeah,
this isn't that important to me. There's got to be something that pulls me into this. And to me, it's like almost like the Issa Rae thing. I'm just rooting for everybody black, right? Sure. I'm really not in that camp. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I'm not in that camp is because I want to know who you are.
If it's good, yeah.
You know, I want to know. So it's like, are you the guy, like, and especially in the NFL, and being a black quarterback in the NFL is like obviously very, very difficult because everyone's expecting you to be an extension of management. That's what mm-hmm. you're there for.
Right.
And so, you know, you're touting the company line almost as much as the coaches, which is why guys like Michael Vick were so refreshing, because it was like, oh, he's, you know, he seemed like he was down and wasn't that dude.
Yeah.
And then of course he went and said crazy stuff too. So yeah, I mean, I always find like at this stage, I am so much more concerned now about class as much as race. Mm-hmm. It's like on the one hand, I'm always race conscious because you have to be. Race, class, and gender, you cannot separate the three. They have to be factored into whatever analyses you're making. But when I look at these athletes today, I always feel like they're in a very, you know, important place. At the end of the heritage, I was talking about this idea really is of, you know, the activist or empire, right? I mean, you're moving in a position at some point. How long can you how long can you do this dance where you're going to be, you know, you're going to be the athlete activist, but at the same time, your net worth is $1 billion.
Right.
At some point, you're going to be more aligned with management. Like if you're following what's happening today, right? You see, you know, LeBron James has his empire and Kevin Durant's got their media empire and Steph Curry's doing his production stuff and Russell Westbrook's doing his production stuff. And Dwayne Wade's got a piece of the Utah Jazz and Shaq's got a piece of the Kings and Serena's got a piece of the Dolphins. And we're touting this as activism. That's not activism. You're a part owner. I mean, it's important because we talk about Black ownership and we talk about these different things, but let's get our terminology straight here, right? Like, right. Are we really celebrating the billionaires right now? I mean, because that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. And I wanted to go back a little bit because you mentioned Michael Vick and you said, I was trying to find the clip on YouTube and I couldn't find it, but maybe you can refresh my memory, but you said it in, oh God, I'm trying to remember what you said it in. You said it in one of these books and you said it on ESPN with regards to Kaepernick. You said, why is the league trying to break him? You know, why are they breaking? And nobody had an answer for that. Nobody said, I don't remember anybody having an answer for that. And with Michael Vick, they broke him. That's why he told Colin to get a haircut.
Mm-hmm.
He was broken. Like they, and it's just like, I was mad at him for saying that, but I understood why he did. I understand.
Want to work? Do you want to work or don't you want to work? These are the conditions of your employment.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's really being said. Why is it so important to break Colin Kaepernick? Because these are the requirements and these are the questions that you're being asked if you're going to be a professional athlete. They want you to fall into a certain dichotomy. You have to follow a certain orthodoxy. And if you're not, then you become the threat, you become the problem. And my issue with this, and it's one of the points that I was trying to make both in the Heritage and Full D, was why is it so important to separate Black people from, you know, or Black athletes from Black communities? Why is it so disqualifying to advocate for a Black position? Why is this one of the prerequisites of your stardom? And why is the price so heavy for simply advocating for a community? Especially when you have awards like the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, where you're supposed to be connected to the community.
Yeah.
And so essentially what you're saying is, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, if they weren't so totally misguided because of the company they're choosing, this is one of the reasons why even some of the Black conservative movements have real roots in the Black community. Historically, we don't need your help.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that today's Black conservatives have sided with people that you can't, how do you align yourself with these people? I may not even argue the merits of your decision of, okay, I don't want your charity. Okay, I'm straight with that. But these are the guys you sign on to?
Mm-hmm.
They are clearly your enemy. And so what's gotten me when it comes to sports, when you're asking where that sort of Full D moment came from, mm-hmm. it was the both the frustration and the rejection of the idea that you're going to sanction me and penalize me for caring about Black people, because that's what you're doing, and just admit that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't even, you know what? You don't even have to admit it. I don't care if you admit it or not, because I know what you're doing.
Right.
Right. You don't even have, you know, you're not hiding it. Nobody's hiding it. Why are we even having, it's like when I go on the air and somebody says, you know, they waste your time, right? Because the starting point is so far back, you never get any progress. So you've got a 4 or 5 minute TV spot and you begin the question with, so Howard, is there a racial problem in America? Why are you wasting my time?
Yeah.
Gee, Jane, I don't know. Let me think about that.
Yeah. And then when you tell them, well, you don't sound enthusiastic that things will change for the better.
Well, that's the other piece of it, right? That's the other part of this sort of full dissonance moment that I had, which is that, you know, and stop fucking calling me to give you hope. You own everything. You control everything. You're supposedly so smart. You're the ones who want test scores to be the determinant of everything. You're suing to keep Black people out of colleges. You know everything. Why are you asking me for hope?
Yeah.
Why do I have to provide this pathway for you since you know so much?
Since you touched on education, I want to read for everybody the passage, my favorite passage from the book. It's like reading your stuff, reading these. It's like when I listen to like one of my favorite MCs and they put something out and I had to run it back a couple times, like, God damn, he said that, to make sure that I got it. And it's like, it's just bars, man. So this is The Lost Tribe of Integration, page 79. You're talking about your Aunt Judy. And I just want to read through this real quick and just kind of have you comment on it. It is a reconsideration that has vindicated my Aunt Judy, who during the days of desegregation in Boston never underestimated the emotional violence that came with pulling her kids away from the Black community. She attended Jeremiah E. Burke High School in Dorchester with my mother. My mother decided to place her children in the proximity of whiteness. My aunt, her best friend, rejected the upward potential of the Lost Tribe. The cost was just too high. I understood the conversations that were taking place, and I knew that the kids were not necessarily getting the education that we received when I was in school. She told me when I asked her why she and my uncle didn't move my cousins out of Boston during busing, as my parents had moved us. But if there were things they weren't learning, we felt we could teach them at home. But you couldn't just rinse away the effects of that kind of isolation. We didn't want to expose our children to it. You might have access to nicer things, but you could lose your sense of self, your identity. And if you did, you might not ever regain it. I thought that to me is just like the paradox that we continue
that's the choice.
To have.
Mm-hmm. That's the choice.
Yeah. And that's like, that's the Metco program in Boston, right? In the Boston area.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you briefly explain that and then like talk?
Sure. Metco during the desegregation years in the early 70s. In fact, Metco started earlier. So the Metco program in Boston during the desegregation years in the 60s and 70s was a voluntary program where suburban schools would take a certain number of African American kids from the inner cities. And that was sort of the compromise because they weren't being required to integrate, which is what the entire Boston busing thing was all about. The white people in the city were upset that they were being forced to integrate their schools, but the folks in the suburbs were insulated from that same integration. Anyway, my parents volunteered my sister and me into that program, which started in 1966. I was in there in the mid 70s. And so we went to school. You know, we grew up in Boston, we were in Dorchester, but we went to school out in the suburbs, out in Newton, surrounded by, you know, white kids and looking at how big their houses were and everything else. And then when the school was over, we had to go back to our communities. And so this is the question. This was the issue was, sure, you were going to have access to better things. You were supposedly going to have access to better education, but you were also going to see all that you didn't have.
Right.
And that, In retrospect, I didn't really think about it at the time, but in retrospect, I absolutely remembered a little bit about, boy, they've got really green grass in their backyards, and they've got one of those jungle gyms with the slide and everything else and the swings, mm-hmm. and they had all the things. And on top of that, you recognized what it meant to, you were beginning this pathway that in some ways is unavoidable if you're going to be a successful Black person in the United States, especially in the corporate United States. But you were starting very, very early being placed against a white backdrop. And you started to realize, very similarly to what we're talking about with sports, mm-hmm. that the closer proximity you have to whiteness, which is to say the further away you get away from Black people, the more your opportunities go up, the more prospects you have. And that is one hell of an equation.
Right. And you have to be extracted from your own community where they need you the most.
And where they need you the most. And if you make any sort of stand, even if it's not an aggressive stand, it's perceived to be an aggressive stand. And the reason why it's perceived to be an aggressive stand is because to them, it is hostile, because they know what they're doing to the Black community.
Right.
They know specifically that if you question this, eventually you're going to be adversaries because of all of the massive disparities. And so there's no way around it.
Right.
And so I think that what you end up with is you end up being forced to make that choice. You end up being a radical without being a radical. You end up being political without even trying to be political. I remember Chris Webber was telling me where he wanted to hire a Black agent
right.
when he first got into the NBA. And even that was considered to be some sort of aggressive, militant move. Just giving a Black person a job was considered being aggressive.
And I didn't realize about his sneaker contract that you talked about in the Heritage. It was like, wow, I didn't even know that. Because he was one of my favorite players coming up. And you would think he would have some shoes. You would think Nike would now be trying to throw out some of his retros so you could buy.
You know?
I talked this because it made this one, that passage, that whole section hit me pretty hard, because not in a bad way, but it made an impact on me because it made me think like I grew up in the Maryland, D.C. area, and PG County, now that we have, we have words for it. They call it now Wakanda in a lot of ways, even though we had problems with the police. Black police will rough you up too and even kill you.
Worse sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes even worse most of the time. But it was you had a sense of, my aunt was a DC educator and she's 84 now, and she sent everybody to Catholic school in DC or wherever. And then my parents followed suit. All of my cousins went, and there's racism there, but in DC, I went to a predominantly Black Catholic school in Maryland and DC and go all the way, really all the way, not Black, but my parents moved me out of a Black Catholic school to go to one closer to home. And there were mainly white kids there.
Yeah.
And that's when I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was about 12. And that's when my parents was like, that's cool, but you got to learn how to be with everybody, and you got to learn how to be in this white world.
Well, and they put you in that place like you're the one who has to always be the accommodator.
Right.
And it's true in so many ways, where when you start really looking at what we're talking about, they're never going to meet you halfway. You are assimilating. It's really not integration. Yeah. What it really is you trying to navigate an environment that doesn't have very many of you. Mm-hmm. And you've got to figure out how to make that work. And when you were asking me about these full distance moments you're having before, the question has always been, okay, like for me personally, I don't really love people anyway as a concept, but but certainly you can always tell the difference between white people one-on-one and white people in a group. When I grew up, I grew up down the South Shore in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And my individual white friends were my friends.
Yeah.
And we were great. And many of us are still friends. But boy, when there was a group of white people around, even they got nervous about supporting me. They weren't sure they should be supporting me because they didn't want to deal with the peer pressure from total strangers saying, what are you supporting him for? They weren't going to stand for you. So I was always very much aware of how to survive when you were in a hostile environment. And what it meant.
How old were you at that time?
Oh, probably high school. Yeah. But, I mean, I was there from third grade on up until high school. Yeah. But, I was like 9 years old. So I was half and half. 9 years in Boston in Black community, 9 years out in the other, out living out in down the Cape. And so, or down the shore. And so, so you realize it's actually one of the reasons why I don't really drink very much is because you just always had to keep your wits about you. You didn't want to be impaired because you start hanging out with white people and all of a sudden the alcohol starts flowing and the racial slurs are not usually far behind the alcohol starts flowing. And so you had to know if some shit hits, what's the plan?
Right. That's funny. I remember, so I went to a private, what they call them PWIs now.
Yeah.
And I went to Mount St. Mary's College. which is now a university. And we lost to Mateen Cleaves and
Michigan State.
Yeah, Michigan State and Mo Pete in 99. And never really had any issues there. There's some where I remember you did a talk. When I was doing my research, you were talking about like your generation was just looking for opportunity.
Yeah.
And now, and I think my generation, I was born in 1980, so I'm a little behind you, but at the same time, it's like, give us the opportunity.
Yeah.
And I kind of come from that same ilk because my parents are in their late 70s, early 80s now. But now these kids now are like, I want the opportunity and you're going to give it to me.
Yeah. I want equality and opportunity.
Yes.
And like I said, growing up, we were never taught equality.
Mm-hmm.
We were always taught they're never going to give you anything. You got to be three times as good.
Yeah.
You know, like you had to be perfect pretty much all the time, but all you're looking for is an opportunity. And once you get the opportunity, then it's up to you to do something with it.
Right. I was just going to say, because it's just like my parents were like, you know, you're Black. They're not better than you, but just realize what's against you and keep plowing away. And it wasn't until my late 30s where I was just like, oh, that stuff was racist. You know, I knew it, but it was just like, I wonder, would I be talking to you, Howard, in a bigger house if certain things broke in a way?
Well, and look at PG County. I always tell people, like, you know, because Black people were always so hard on each other in terms of the choices we make and who's trying to, you know, whether or not you're selling out, whether you're Tommen and this and that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, let's just suppose, okay, that you are Black and you really like the mountains. You just like topography. Or you just like, you like rural environments because that's what you gravitate toward, and you don't necessarily feel comfortable being in a megalopolis. You don't want to live around 20 million people or however many, right? Where can you go and not immerse yourself in whiteness? Where is the rural middle-class Black community?
Right.
Right. So in other words, just making a geographical, topographical choice. I like to go kayak. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I want to be around white people, or is that just where the water is?
You just like, that's right? What you like. Yeah.
I mean, these are the questions that we have to make, and we're incredibly harsh with each other on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I'm not a people person. I don't live in New York anymore. I live in New York and be around all them people, being around that many people. Mm-hmm. Everything is just very, very difficult. And so you've got to then, but think about the choices you make if you make that choice. Think about what's coming next, what your social circle is going to be, who you're going to date, what if you decide to have a family and have kids, where are you putting them? Mm-hmm. You're essentially choosing whiteness for them, even if that's not what you want to do, simply because that's how it works.
Yeah.
Which is why you try to go to a place like PG County. But even then, when I was working at the Washington Post, you could see that those numbers, when the economy dropped, even PG County, which is the Black middle class, you know, like Atlanta and Houston, one of those three or four spots in the country where you feel like, okay, there's a thriving Black middle class here. It got hit worse.
Yeah.
And Black wealth hasn't come back really that much since 2008, since that crash. And so it's you're just up against it. And it's not people, what are you making excuses? You're not making excuses. This is simply the reality of the situation. Here's what's in front of you.
And that's the thing, like, because I think the thing with me was like coming up was just like never. Yeah, you're Black and I'm proud to be Black. I love being Black. But there's racism, but don't use it as a crutch. And I think that I kind of tried to put blinders on and plow through. And then even though like I've had some success and I feel like I'm 41 and just really just getting started. It's sort of like, it's like, okay, well, whoa, I'm looking back. That's racist. Like this education stuff was a little racist and it's not me trying to make excuses, but it's like, ugh.
Well, and you notice how much we're constantly on the defensive simply by stating facts. Yeah, I'm not trying to make excuses. This is what it is, man. Like people say to me, oh, why are you whining and complaining all the time? I'm not whining nor complaining. I have a good life. I have money. I can take care of myself. I'm fine. But that doesn't change what this is. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So let's not misdirect here. I'm not talking necessarily about myself. I'm saying this is what this is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and there's no escaping that piece of it.
Right.
And so, as I tell people all the time, I'm not trying to change your mind. I don't care if you agree with me or don't. This is what I think. This is what I have to say. This is my life as I see it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, to me, when I'm looking at, you know, Full D, you're looking at the beginning and the end of that book. You look at the intro and you look at Renters, the epilogue.
Right.
This is the story of navigation. And to me, this is how you navigate the world that you're brought into. And these are some of the limits of that negotiation, that these are some of the areas where you can't survive it, right? I mean, you can survive it, but where the negotiation collapses.
Right.
And, you know, there are a couple of other chapters in the book where you really, you know, where those questions sort of, I wanted to examine those questions, which is what is the price that you're paying for this continued facade? And maybe you're better off not playing anymore. Like, your liberation comes from recognizing, I don't have to play anymore. I don't want to sit and argue with you about the reasons why you voted for Donald Trump or that you're friend. I don't care anymore. I tell my son all the time, these conversations are essentially white people talking to other white people. They don't really have anything to do with me. Right. I mean, my path continues on whether we have these conversations or whether we don't. And so where is the benefit to me engaging in these conversations?
Right.
There is no benefit to me. The benefit is talking to other Black people about where we're at, yeah, and about how to navigate this hostile territory that we're in.
Right. Because it mutates. It constantly evolves, and it's just.
Well, and it also has nothing to do. It also has nothing to do with illumination, right? It's like, you don't need me to look this stuff up. You know, you don't need. It's all right in front of you, yeah, right? It's like when people, you know, people talk about policing. It's like, you don't need me for this. Look it up. You say you believe in the data, go look at the data. You don't need me for it. But the point is that deep down, people aren't interested in the data of it. They're interested in the emotion of it. The very same things that they will accuse you for about being emotional is very emotional to them. Like when you talk about police, you know, one of the big differences between white and Black people in this country when it comes to policing is that policing is extremely emotional to white people, because policing, that industry, literally put food on their tables. Well, my dad was a cop and his dad was a cop. So now you're talking generations,
right,
of being emotionally and personally tied to this occupation. We just don't want you to shoot us.
Right. We just want to be left alone.
You just want to be left alone, right?
That's their integration into whiteness.
No, that's right.
If they're immigrants and they come over, that's how they're inducted.
Yeah. How did you cross over? How did you get into these things? And yeah, so this is really, these things are really important. And at some point you recognize that I can't be carrying this much anymore. I don't want to carry this much anymore.
Yeah.
Every Black person in the country knows what we're talking about.
Right. Right?
In terms of, if you start to have a little bit of success as you begin to move into these different spaces, mm-hmm, it's not just that you're moving into the different spaces. It's that you are expected to abandon.
Right.
You're expected to leave the Black community behind. And you've heard it. It exists in the language. It exists in the, oh, well, you know, this isn't the good guy to hang out with anymore. You can hang out with the wrong crowd of people and all of that. Or, you know, you've gone beyond that, or as a way out. All of the different phraseologies that we've used. You hear it all the time. And that stuff isn't harmless. Mm-hmm. That's the same stuff as you go when you start looking at where we are in sports, where you start looking at the different athletes and the different stories, whether you're talking about Colin Kaepernick or whomever else. And you begin to ask this question as people talk about athlete activism and the rest of it, which I've always found to be nonsensical, because the real question that's being asked of you is, why is advocating for your own people disqualifying? Why are you putting your entire career at risk simply advocating for Black people, right? Mm-hmm. That's the real issue of what we're talking about. What we're talking about is that if you talk about this, if you support Black people, then you are risking your entire livelihood. And when you put it that way, it sounds so heinous.
Right.
Right. But that's really what's happening. So why did Tommy Smith and John Carlos lose their careers? Because they advocated for Black people. Why did Colin Kaepernick lose his career? He advocated for Black people, right? These things, when they happen, you know exactly what the reason is. And so to me, you listen to all these people talk about athlete activism. You listen to them talk about player empowerment, and I'm using my platform and I'm using my position. And I look at that and I think about it from the counter perspective, which is, how much power do you really have if you lose everything by opening your mouth?
Right. Right. Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like you have to, the heritage is not a club that you want to be in. Like,
no, absolutely one you don't want to be in.
Yeah, it's righteous, but at the cost of you losing everything.
And that's the calculation, right? I mean, mm-hmm. to me, this is the central part of all of this. It's mm-hmm. not whether you knelt or whether you didn't. It's not what positions you took. It's, why is this the equation?
Right, right.
Why? What is so threatening about supporting Black people that you risk everything you have by saying something in support of that community, especially when the leagues go out of their way to talk about their Walter Payton Man of the Year awards and the right. NBA cares and all the other charity stuff. So what they're really saying is that you can support Black people as long as it's charity, but if you try to empower Black people, now you're a threat.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's almost like it's not fair. We do this all the time, and the Black, I don't want to say that, because then that would be another type of podcast, and we could be we can make a lot of money doing it, but it's not the right way to do it. I feel like we kind of put it on Ali, we put it on LeBron, we put it on Naomi mm-hmm. Osaka to be everything to everybody. And then it's not fair. And that's like, I'm at fault too with my Black quarterbacks. Like, you think you want them to do it so you can hold your head up a little higher at the job that you hate or whatever. And it's just not fair to be asking these people who are celebrities. They're not government officials.
You know? But fair has got nothing to do with it.
Right.
What it is that these are the ones who made it. These are the people yeah. who have the opportunities to do things that we can't do. They're the ones who are the pinnacle of success. And I think that what it is that we look to them in a lot of ways because we're looking for people that we feel aren't as encumbered as we are.
Right.
And then we realize that they are. They've yeah. got $50 million in the bank and still are risking their entire career. You'd think that the money would give you some form of relief, some sort of, as they used to say, fuck you ability, but right. you don't have that, mm-hmm. right? So, and you're also saying, okay, if you can take a LeBron James, you can take a Colin Kaepernick, or you can take, whomever, take whatever superstar Black athlete you want. If you can muzzle them at their level, what chance do the rest of us have?
Right.
Right. If you look at it that way. And I think that's sometimes an appropriate way to look at it, because that's also the calculation for suppressing them.
Right.
That the message is that no matter who you are in this country, we can put you down.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bleak when you really break it down. Like, but I at the same time, I didn't feel that the Heritage or Full Dissidence was bleak. It just kind of it added context to my emotions, where it made me feel like less alone, because okay, this is why, these are salient points, facts, that why these things exist, and mm-hmm. my emotions are valid. Because one thing you touched on in the first part of our conversation last week, we make our excuses. Like, Black people, myself, I was doing it in the conversation. I was like, Well, I'm not saying, you know, it's racist, but I didn't complain, or I'm not using, because my big thing was back then, I didn't want to use race as a crutch. I knew it was there, like racism as a crutch. And it's just this dance that we constantly have to do. And like you said, the freedom comes when you don't feel like you have to play anymore. You know,
100%. And I think that, I don't think it's bleak either. I don't find either book to be bleak.
They're freeing.
And there were so many times where that book, you know, especially Full D, where, mm-hmm. you know, white people would talk to me and they would say, where do you see hope? And I would say, I see a lot of hope. Yeah. I feel like incredibly hopeful. My hope is realizing I don't have to listen to you anymore.
Yeah.
My hope comes from recognizing that I'm not here to change your mind. I'm not trying to convince you of anything. I have a lot of hope. My hope comes from being free of you,
mm-hmm.
of being liberated from you.
Right.
You know, I'm not here to convince you of my humanity or that I'm a really good person. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Right. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And what I do care about is I care about my community and I care about my friends and I care about my people and I care about my values and I care about the world and all of that stuff. But I don't have to convince you that there's value to my existence. That there's value right. to me. I mean, that's the difference. And yeah. I think that's the last sentence of the book. It's really not. It's the way it was a freeing sense for me.
Yeah.
So I always felt like the number of times that you get asked when you're working on projects or working at a big place like ESPN or wherever, do you have an opportunity to say the things you want to say?
Right.
Are you able to speak the way you want to speak? And to me, the point is that yes. Yeah, I am. And that is incredibly liberating and hopeful and fun and all of the things, because you don't feel like you have to amputate every piece of you just to have a job.
Is there some catharsis? Like, we talk about the freedom in doing these two projects. Do you feel some like catharsis when you write the way you do, when you write about the issues that you write about, even in your journalistic pieces, like your Bruce Maxwell stuff?
Well, yeah, I think so, because what we do, and why do we write? What do we say? We you know, when you're doing stand-up, what are you doing? You're talking about things that you find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And to most times when you work, you're working for somebody else, you're doing their work, you're doing what they need done. That's what work is, unless mm-hmm. you're self-employed, right?
Right?
You're doing what somebody else needs done and they've chosen you to do that. So it's obviously really, really great to be in positions periodically where you get to express yourself. One of the reasons why I enjoy doing books is that books are mine. I'm not doing somebody else's work. I'm saying what I feel I need to say. So that's always, always gratifying. And so, and I think that when you get a chance to translate that into your day job as well, it's even better.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think the thing is that so many of us, when we get into these spaces, feel like the last thing we can do is advocate for Black people or talk about Black people or say anything in a way that we would talk in a way that we would say around the way we can't say it
mm-hmm.
in your corporate spaces. And so, you know, it's the classic code switch.
Right.
So
right.
to be able to say, okay, here's how I feel about something and not have to amputate, to not change your mind, not change your feelings or feel like you have to muzzle yourself is great.
Yeah.
And I always think about this where you can see it in the language as well, right? Like you can see it when you're reading other people. Like when I do critiques of other reporters or other writers, you know, when they ask me,
mm-hmm.
I would always say, don't apologize. Don't apologize in your paragraphs. Not to be racist, comma, but get that out of there. Eliminate it. Just say what you need to say. Just say what you need to say, because how many people out there, I said, when all these white reporters are out there, they're not thinking about your feelings when they're writing these bullshit racist columns.
Mm-hmm.
They're not considering how you feel. They're saying what they want to say, and they trample and steamroll everybody. So if you have something you have to say, don't apologize for it before you even say it.
True.
You know, step into your paragraph, make a good argument, do your research, do your homework, know your history, and say what you have to say, especially us of all people, because history is on our side.
Right.
Right. There's right. no,
yeah.
This isn't theory. This isn't, mm-hmm. you know, you know, hypothetical. This isn't my opinion. This is fact.
And how much does an editor, when you're shape you, especially when you're writing books, how much does an editor shape what you, what's going to end up in the final product? Because I know you credit your editors sometimes, but how do I want to say, we talked earlier about how if something leans toward one way, it could be misinterpreted. And then
it depends on how good the editor is. I mean, it really does. It depends on the relationship you have with the editor. It depends on if your editor is interested in your success or if the editor has a mandate to keep you down.
Right.
And if the editor is scared of the publication more than you are. And so there had been times in my career where I remember, I don't remember when it was one time at ESPN, I remember. And I remember asking, you know, do we have a mandate not to mention whatever subject X? And one of my editors would say, no, we don't. And I would say, is there a mandate from the company that says we can't talk about this subject? And they would say, no. I said, has anybody told us that we can't discuss this subject? And they would say, no. And I'd say, then don't soften my shit.
Mm.
You know, if there's no mandate, then let me say what I have to say.
Right.
Now, there are other times when you do have an editor come in and they're trying to make it better. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to keep you tight and keep you focused. And there are times when, as a writer, you may say, I want to go way over here. And you may mute your own point, or you may distract your own point by saying too much on a given subject or getting too personal in another area. And so the editor, as long as the editor is always trying to make you better, you're in good shape. And as long as you can always trust that the editor's goal is to make you better, I think it usually works. You're fine. Sometimes I don't agree with it. And then other times I'll step back after I get the edit back. And I'm like, yeah, this was extraneous. It wasn't necessary. And you may think that it's fire, right? You may think, mm-hmm. okay, I really nailed this sentence. Or you may think, okay, this is a really good, like, you know, left hook punch. And then you realize that you went too far on it because it distracts your point. Now, instead of people talking about what the column's about, they're talking about, you know, this gratuitous shot you took at somebody.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's better for you. Maybe the editor was right to just get that out so you can stay focused. Here's the issue that I want you, the reader, to pay attention to.
Gotcha. Because were there instances? I think you did a talk for the Heritage, I believe it was in Boston, and you talked a little bit. Someone asked you a question. I think you talked a little bit about how there was some stuff you wanted to keep in the Heritage, but you decided to take out. Was there?
Well, that's a process that takes place in every book.
I mean like there was like a large chunk that you were like, I maybe save that one or.
Yeah, I kind of think like, I don't remember specifically. I mean, that, you know, I wrote that book 3 years. I mean, it came out.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote that book 4 years ago.
Yeah.
But absolutely, in terms of the construction of the book,
okay.
I had huge sections of the book. You're probably referring to the original outline. The original outline of the book and what the book is are two totally different things. I had a chapter on the Williams sisters that never got in the book. I had chapters, I had all kinds of different chapters in the book that never made it. And part of the reason they didn't make it was because with that type of book, obviously, and where we were at 2014 to 2017, things just kept moving every day. Every day there was something new happening. And so it was hard to keep track of. And also, I wanted to pull back on something because I was thinking you also have to make sure that these ideas are going to hold up. And right. So I was making sure I was challenging myself to understand exactly what I was talking about. Right. Like we all get on this bandwagon about athlete activism. And I'm like, okay, you are making an argument about a heritage of Black political athlete. I mean, a Black, you know, politics with athletes, of the Black political athlete, let's put it that way. And that is an exclusive club. What constitutes a heritage, right? So now I'm going back and forth and I'm like, okay, now if you take this person, assess this person. And I just concluded, I'm like, okay, remember, I know this world is moving really quickly. I know that there are all kinds of people who are being, you know, who are visible. I know that there is a feeling now that everybody is somehow adding to this movement. But do you really get to be placed in the pantheon of Tommy Smith and John Carlos and Muhammad Ali for wearing a t-shirt? That's all it takes. So yeah. Now I had to pull back on myself. I'm like, wait a minute, let's be real about this. Who's actually in the work? Who's doing what? Mm-hmm. And I had concluded that some of these people that I had planned on writing about hadn't quite reached the bar. That they had, and I wasn't sure they were going to hold up. And I didn't want this book to talk about people and then have me go back and look at them and go, yeah, you didn't quite measure up. I was like, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait on certain people and we'll see what you're all about over time. Sure. Just like by the time I got to the end of the book, I started asking another question. And it's a real question now, which is with the athletes, can you be the protester and the power at the same time? So when you start looking at what players are doing, now we're talking about LeBron James one day wanting to own this and that, and he's got a production company and he makes movies. Right. And Serena Williams owns a piece of the Miami Dolphins, and Shaquille O'Neal owns a piece of the Sacramento Kings, and Dwayne Wade owns a piece of the Utah Jazz. And
right.
So, okay, great. You own sports teams now. You have a piece of a sports team. Is that activism or is that empire? That's not activism.
No.
So you're the boss. I mean, so how are you going to be protesting the boss and being the boss at the same time? So there's value, obviously, because there are no Black owners outside of Michael Jordan. There's value in the fact that these athletes have an opportunity for equity and generational wealth and all those things. But that's not the same as being in the street.
Right.
Right. That's not the same as activism.
Yeah, people have, I don't know, they've ruined the definitions of those.
Well, we so badly want everything to mean something.
Yeah.
And we so badly want the athletes to feel heroic. And we're so badly are shut out from the power circles. We think just being in that power circle is somehow beneficial, but it's not necessarily. Mm-hmm. One, most of these guys have 1 or 2% of a team. Two, how do we know that once you get into that room, you're just going to mimic the people who are already in the room?
That's so fascinating. I don't know if you watched that show that just ended, The White Lotus on HBO.
No, I haven't started it yet. I just finished Exterminate All the Brutes. And now okay. I am Raoul Peck, which is phenomenal, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm,
he did, I'm not your Negro, episode right?
Three. What's that?
Peck did. I'm not,
your I am Negro. Not your Negro.
Okay. Yes. All right.
And I'm on like episode 2 or 3 of Mayor from Easttown.
Oh my God. Howard, I did a separate podcast about Mayor of Easttown. Phenomenal. As soon as Kate Winslet started speaking in that Delco dialect, I said, okay.
I went to college with a bunch of you mayors.
Yeah, when she said overdose, I was like, okay, she's not fucking around. She was
exactly. She's like, let me get a glass of water, and she's grabbing some Rolling Rock. I'm like, okay, you're in character. You are in character.
I want to talk about that a little later too, man. But like, what stuff you're watching? But yeah, it's one of those things where I think that I have to pull myself out of too, where you see these Black athletes and these celebrities doing it. And you wrote about that, you know, and I think it was in Full Dissonance. They're all in, I read them so close together that it's hard to put them apart, but I believe you did write about the celebrities and what
we're expecting. Yeah, and that was I was going to say, that was part of, you know, when I started working on Full D, I wanted to actually start to take a look at some of the things that I had said in the Heritage.
Yeah.
And challenge them, right? I'm more critical of Colin Kaepernick in Full D than I was in the Heritage. Mm-hmm. I'm more critical of the athletes in Full D than I was in the Heritage. And part of the reason is because you're starting to, you know, because time is passing and there's a lot to reflect upon. And I had to check myself and ask myself, okay, why do I feel the way I feel about certain things? Like, for example, you know, when it came to someone like Kaepernick, you know, I was thinking how much and was I giving him, you know, why was I not in as great of support of him at first? Why was I wavering so much? Why was I unclear on how I felt about this? It wasn't just because he wasn't giving interviews or whatever. There was something else. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that, as I said in the book, there was absolute reason to support him even more.
Right.
And it was because you have an entire system of industry. Of a country, whether it's the highest levels of the federal government or whether it's policing, or whether it's law enforcement, that are trying to destroy this man.
Yeah.
Right. So because they're trying to destroy him, he deserves our protection.
Right. And that's why I thought it was really profound when you asked Stephen A and them on one of those shows. You're like, why are you trying to break him? Why mm-hmm. are you trying? And it's just like, and nobody has ever had an answer for that.
Yeah. Why is it so important to break this man? Why?
Yeah. And I was like, yes, Howard. I was like, thank you. Because it's I don't know, man. Like when I was a kid, Doug Williams won the Super Bowl when I was 8 years old. And I thought that's what it was going to be. I thought it was going to be like that, because that's when you start to, like before I was like 10 years old, when you start to come online with a lot of this stuff, like a lot of these achievements that people are having.
Yep.
And then to see him get, because he was like in his 30s when he won. And
Doug Williams. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't, and people like revisionist history tries to say when he said, look, they said, you're the first black quarterback. He's like, I'm a quarterback and I am. But I think that's him just being, I'm 30. I'm trying to win this game.
Yeah.
I'm trying to have a career.
Well, and there's more to it than that. To me, there's another piece of that, which is, you know, you want to call me the first black something? Fine. Mm-hmm. Right. You call me the first black something when you are convinced that nobody black before me could have done it. Otherwise, all you're saying is I'm the first one you gave a shot to.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything to me. Right. If there's 200 years or 300 years of black people who could be doing the same thing I'm doing and you didn't let them, that says more about you than it says about my ability. Don't isolate me as some sort of special case when really what's special about this is the lack of opportunity that your industries are allowing us to have. You're killing us.
It's like what you did to Warren Moon.
Exactly. That's Rodney the Lee. Issue. It's like, don't look at me.
Yeah.
Look at you. You know, man. I mean, I'm for real. I'm like just saying, like, what, you know, and you see it now post George Floyd. You see it more now than ever. I'm the first black photographer to be on the cover of Vogue. I'm the first black person to do that. And I'm thinking, this is so stupid.
Yeah.
I'm like, are you really going to call this an accomplishment? Everybody should be ashamed of themselves that you haven't hired a black person to take a picture for a magazine and you've been around
Gordon for 120 Parks years. Wept. Gordon and Parks Webb. You're
going to tell me that I've got such a spectacular artistic eye that I'm the one? Come on.
Yeah. Well, what got you into writing? What inspired you to write? And like, what inspired you to write the way you do and the things that you talk about? Like when you were a kid?
I don't know. I mean, I think that to me, obviously one of the biggest things that was important was, you know, growing up in Boston as we did, and then leaving early on, you know, halfway through, and then going out to, you know, Plymouth, you know, home of the Pilgrims and everything else, when you're out there, you know, really one of the only black people around, you know, that white backdrop absolutely informs how you deal with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like there was always so much, for me, there was always so much apologizing. There was always so much, you're always trying to accommodate. Because you were the minority. You were trying to accommodate because, you know, you want to have friends, right? So obviously you're not going to alienate everybody, but you realize how many people are actually looking out for you.
Right.
How many people actually care about you enough to think about the impact the world is having on you? I mean, these people are calling you friend.
Mm-hmm.
They're calling you friend. You are my best friend, right? You are, you know, you're my girlfriend or whatever. All these people that we're surrounded ourselves by. And then you start to find out who they are and what they believe and how they view the world. And you try to square, how do you look at the world that way and still hang out with me? How are you able to have that disconnect?
Yeah. Yeah.
How are you able to have these views and still hang out with me when you know these views are directly affecting me and people like me?
Right.
Right. So to me, I also realized that there was going to come a point where it was like, wait a minute. That's not a question you ask them anymore. That's a question you ask yourself. Why are you hanging out with people that you know have no interest in you or your well-being, or that are able to make that distinction, that they're able to feel and think about you in very destructive ways, and you know that about them, and you still put yourself in those environments? Now, you got to flip that around.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, why don't I care enough about myself to put myself in better environments, in more nurturing environments, in more complete environments? Yeah. As a kid, it makes perfect sense. You got no choice. This is where you live. This, you got to deal with this until you graduate. But once you're a grown-up, it's your choice who you choose to spend your time with.
What attracted you to Temple to study there?
Oh, I went to Temple because my girlfriend was there. But I also had family there, right? I was gonna say, I got a 17-year-old right now, and I'm trying to be like the greatest hypocrite parent ever, talking about all the different reasons why you choose school and here this is what this, you know, university offers, and this is what this program offers. I went to Temple because my girlfriend was there.
Okay.
That was why I went, right? But when I was there, I was so happy to be there. Also because I had family there.
Okay.
You know, my uncle and, you know, my aunt and my cousins, they lived right over the bridge in Jersey.
Oh, okay.
And Philly was just so great to be in. And it was good to be in a majority Black environment for one of the first times since I was a kid, since growing up in Boston.
Yeah.
And so you realize how much you needed that and realize how much I needed that.
Sure.
And that was real. And it was good to be away from home. And Temple was, you know, I used to call it the honorary HBCU, but, you know, I know that was a bit of hyperbole, but
for you, it was and it worked. Yeah.
What's that?
For you, it was and it worked.
Well, I mean, that, but it being in North Philly and everything else, I mean, it was legit. I needed to be at that school. That school was phenomenal to me for the most part. Mm-hmm. And it was a place. It was a place where you got to figure out who you were and who you were going to be and how you were going to navigate very difficult environments.
Yeah.
Wouldn't trade it for anything.
And you were writing for the paper there, right?
Temple?
Were you writing for the school paper?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I was editor of school paper.
Okay. So were you already entrenched in that, like in high school? And
I knew I wanted to be a reporter when I was in like the eighth grade.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I mean, I always knew I wanted to do it. I didn't know how it was going to happen. I'll always say I'm one of the worst people to ask when it comes to, you know, doing the job, because I had it easy in a lot of ways because I knew what I wanted to do. It was simply a matter of how do you get it?
Right.
That was the big thing for me. It wasn't, I don't know what my major is going to be. I'm undeclared. Now I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to write. I wanted to write in some form, and I knew I wanted to be a reporter. So then the question was simply going to be, how do you get there? How do you become a reporter? Mm-hmm. I didn't walk on a college campus going, I don't know what I want from this place. I wasn't like that at all. I went immediately once I had the courage to walk into the student newspaper. I've been doing this ever since.
That's great, man. It's always better when you know what you want to do at a young age. I think it's been the road has had it's I've had my ups and downs, but I always knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Did you move to the Bay Area after college and start your career?
Yeah.
What kind of things were you reporting on before you made the shift to sports?
Excuse me. I was covering high schools.
Okay.
At first I got there, I got a job at the Oakland Tribune because of this massive, deadly Oakland Hills fire, and they brought me on as more staff. I was like a staff. I was like a copy boy there. It was, you know, I was really, really entry level. And then I got a job doing some, couple times a week covering some sporting events, doing some high schools and whatnot. And then I switched over. I went to business and covered business and technology, and I stayed in tech for years.
Because you were on. Oh, sorry.
What's up?
I was going to say you were working in tech, covering tech at the rise of the internet, right?
Absolutely. I was in Silicon Valley at the San Jose Mercury News right when that was happening.
What was it like to be at ground zero of that? Like, knowing what you know now, what was it like to be right in the heart of it?
It was tremendous. It was an amazing learning experience, and it really, really helped me covering sports, because when I walked in, you know, if I had gone straight from being a sports fan, having, you know, Dr. J and Magic Johnson and, you know, all the guys and George Gervin on my walls, to going into a clubhouse or a locker room, I might have been a little more shell shocked. I might have been a little bit more surprised, I might have had a little bit more stardust in my eyes. But having come from tech, I'd already covered Bill Gates and covered Larry Ellison and covered Eric Benamou and covered these people, you know, who were making gazillions of dollars. And you walk in, I'm like, I've already covered rich people.
Right.
I'm already used to this. I'm not intimidated as much by being in this room because I covered those guys.
Yeah.
If I can sit in a room and interview Bill Gates, I think I can handle a guy who's in his underwear, you know, talking about, you know, baseball.
Did you ever meet Steve Jobs?
Never. I didn't cover Apple.
Okay. Oh, Microsoft.
Yeah, I was covering. I was on the telecom side. I was covering telecommunications. So most of the people I covered were more on telecom.
Are you a tech guy at all? Like, do you have to have the latest tech?
Not anymore. I mean, when I first got into it, I was definitely techie, and you know, part of my job, I was a columnist. I was covering video game industry. So I always had toys. But once I got back into sports, it's all functional stuff now.
Got you. Do you ever, you don't, I guess maybe your son probably games, but I doubt that.
No, he's a big gamer. Yeah. I'm not anymore.
Was it hard to get does he have a PlayStation 5 or Xbox, whatever
new? He has neither. He's been playing off of the Switch for years now. He's addicted to the Switch. I was going to get him. I'm like, are we going? We have a PS4. That was the last one. I said, are we going PS5? He's like, nah.
Wow.
I was surprised.
Okay.
But he was never a huge PS guy. I was the PlayStation guy.
Okay.
He was a Wii guy. He was playing Wii, and he was playing, you know, Wii U and DS and all the more handheld stuff.
Gotcha. I was at a party last night. We were all vaccinated, and I was trying to play Switch. I couldn't do it.
No, I mean, I look at, you just reach a certain point age wise with a button combination. You're like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Right.
I can't
execute a kick right now because I don't have the button combinations and I don't want to play anymore.
It's hard. It's hard. Like I'm debating on whether I should get Madden or every year I always dump money into that and barely play it. When did you start covering sports? Like, when did you make that shift? I think there was a story I heard or that you were telling about, like covering like you were in the Bay Area and you were covering a story about a kid that got killed or something, and you kind of had enough. You wanted to make a shift, or was there?
When I was at the Oakland Tribune, you know, trying to decide where I was going to go, like what did I feel like covering? I just realized I wasn't covering murders. I mean, I had to go, you know, some kid got killed in a crossfire, and I had to go to East Oakland and pick up a photo of the child so they could put his picture in the paper, like a school picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen all of those news stories, and then there's like some eighth grade school photo, and that was just traumatizing for me. And you know, I was like, I didn't really want to do this, and I didn't. And it wasn't just that I didn't want to do it because it was hard to deal with. Obviously, the families involved had to deal with it much more acutely than I did. But it was also just how callous it became after a while, because the murder numbers just pile up. And they cease to become people half the time. And I was like, I don't want to be part of this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to close, like, early last week we were talking, and we talked about Last Black Man in San Francisco and Jonathan Majors. I want to know before we get into like some of the stuff you've liked this year or the past year, like as far as film are concerned, I wanted you to rank the three Marvel TV shows, WandaVision, Falcon, and Loki. I wanted to know your thoughts on those.
That is a good question. Well, one, you can't really do Loki because it's not done yet, because it's That's got true. Two seasons. But if we assess the first season, I would say WandaVision is still my favorite.
Oh, okay.
WandaVision is still my favorite because WandaVision was so unique.
Mm-hmm.
You really had no idea what to expect. It's like, okay, well, what is this about? And then the way they did it, such a great homage to television. Mm-hmm. Like if you're WandaVision was perfect if you're my age or a little younger, because you're old enough, like I'm old enough to have remembered, at least in reruns, the early episodes of WandaVision where, you know, they're doing the Dick Van Dyke type, you know, in the Bewitched, you know, they're doing those types of plays, you know, play on those shows. But I don't remember the later ones because I was grown and out of, you know, in college or whatever. I wasn't watching the Wonder Years or some of those little.
That's what know, that was in my at the, pocket. At
the
yeah. end,
right. So I don't remember those. But, you know, the Partridge Family one, the, you know, Bewitched and all of those. I got those. I thought it was a brilliant way I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant way to introduce the idea of grief and suffering, because so much of what happens in our lives is attached to our popular culture. Yeah. When we think about our youth, we're thinking about the TV shows we used to watch. And if you're a real movie person or if you're a real TV person, it really was a fantastic sort of tribute to what television meant to our lives.
Yeah.
Especially when you come from, you know, from that generation where you had three networks and everybody was watching the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was such a universality about that. And I thought it was really good. I thought that by the end, obviously, things started to fall apart a little bit because it was very difficult to, once you start adding more characters and you're running out of episodes, it's like, how are you going to tie all this together?
Right.
That was
right.
That was the real difficult part. And once you brought in the Agnes, you know, Agatha Harkness character, you really, now it's like, okay, this story is taking, now it's going to become a superhero story. You got to sort of figure out what to do with that.
Sure.
But I thought it was brilliant. And I thought the storyline was brilliant. And I thought it was so inventive. I thought it was really, really smart. And it took a lot of thought to do it. Really clever. I thought Falcon and the Winter Soldier, I will give Falcon and Winter Soldier credit for a couple of things. One is just its action.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that they did a really good job in terms of trying to show that these Avengers exist in the real world. That
yeah.
they still have lives and they're not distant from those lives. I was laughing at the number of times Sam Wilson's out here making promises to people he can't keep. I was like, damn, black man, you really do believe in America, don't you? You think you can make a phone call? How many people are you making promises to that you're getting clowned at the bank? You're getting clowned everywhere. And you're still like, I can help you. Who are you gonna help? You can't help yourself.
I was so it's so funny that you mentioned that. Like I almost want to give, I love WandaVision. I've loved Elizabeth Olsen since Martha Marcy May Marlene in 2011. But I was just pleasantly surprised by the blackness of Falcon and the Winter Soldier because it was so, I'm not really steeped in the literature of the comic books.
Yeah, but
I was just like, whoa. I was like, he can't get a bank loan. He can't get this. And he still believes in the country. Isaiah Bradley's like, I don't believe
his
in this.
His level of belief.
Yeah.
His level of belief was, I thought they did a fantastic job of showing how stuck black people really are early on. And that, okay, what choice do you have?
Right.
And I thought that there was a great meditation on, you know, Sam being a true believer.
Yeah.
That he really was a believer in this idea of a dream. Mm-hmm. I thought it was also crazy that he kept believing. I don't like what they did to the Isaiah Bradley character. I didn't like how it ended. I thought it fell apart for me. However, I did understand the Isaiah Bradley character to a point. Okay. And that point was he was hurt.
Yeah.
He was wounded. What he wanted was an acknowledgement of what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And that would he have come around so quickly simply with a thank you? Sometimes that is all it takes.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite sure in his case that was all it took, but that's the direction that the show went in. But I liked it. I really, you know, I think that I would go. I think I would go as for Loki, I thought Loki was, we'll see where it ends up.
Yeah.
I thought Loki had the toughest job of the three, which is eventually how do you turn a villain into a protagonist, right? Oh. That the story is about somebody who eventually kills people. Right. I mean, if you're a Loki, you're a bad guy. You're a murderer. You have killed many, many, many people. Mm-hmm. Right. And to that end, I was wondering how they were going to pull off the shtick of, you know, of Tom Hiddleston being Loki and having it not get old. We know Loki is you know, force of nature character, right? Tom Hiddleston's a great actor, force of nature on screen, wonderful actor on screen. However, how many times can you pull off the fact that we all know Loki's going to double cross you? It's right. Like, you know, you can't trust Loki. So how many more times can you get away with that and keep the story flowing?
Right.
So obviously bringing in the Sylvie character and having Loki essentially hunt other Lokis allowed him to be a protagonist because he's the Loki you want to survive, right? The other Lokis, you're trying to figure out what they're all about. So I thought that was sort of clever. And of course, when you started to get to, now being a comic book guy that I am, I knew that you had to end up at Kang the Conqueror. I thought it was going to be Scarlet Centurion, to be honest. And now I'm going to geek out on you. I thought it was going to be Scarlet Centurion. However, Scarlet Centurion and Kang the Conqueror are essentially the same character. They're just in different generations.
Okay.
So I was right as I was guessing where this was going. I didn't know that they were going to go with Jonathan Majors. I thought that was a great pickup there. I wasn't quite sure if I wanted to see that character be serious or if he was going to be that sort of, you know, the jokester, the killer with the high sense of humor, the way Majors played it. But it was absolutely entertaining. It was really good. All three of them have been really entertaining in their own ways.
Oh, yeah. I enjoy them all. And I was just really impressed by the blackness of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. It was a different blackness than Black Panther. It was like it was fascinating. I was like, oh, they went there. It's like the first, we were talking about Chappelle last week, and I opened for Neil Brennan a few years back, and I told him, I said, look, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but that blind white supremacist Clayton Bixby, I can't believe it was funny, but I was like, I can't believe they let them do that.
Yeah.
And I felt the same way with this Falcon and the Winter. I was like, oh my God, they're talking about this stuff at this huge platform. They're talking about all this stuff.
Yeah, but what they did at the end of the day was they still allowed rehabilitation. But the one thing about these stories that I really don't like is, can you please just let a black man be mad if he's mad? You know, why you don't have to do that.
You know, they don't, you know, Howard, they always ask you to shine a light on things.
You gotta be a hope whisperer. You have to be the hope whisperer. Hmm. And I'm like, you know what? Isn't it okay to just let me live the life that I've lived and have you be okay with that?
Yeah.
And to give me my dignity. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, you can't make up for everything. You can't make everything right. And that was the thing about Sam. Sam's out there thinking he can make everything right. He's not right. And so, you know, it was so funny. I had a nickname for him during the show.
Uh-oh. Can we say it on the pod? I don't want to get you in trouble. Don't get...
No. I was calling him Checkers. Everybody else was playing chess. He was the one playing Checkers the whole time. Checkers Wilson. Right? It's true. It's true, man. Everybody else is playing chess, and here's Sam thinking he's gonna make a phone call for you, and he's the one ending up with. Carly was playing chess. Zima was playing chess. Wakandans were playing chess, and he's the one still. Isaiah was playing. He's the one playing checkers. Because he was the true believer.
He was the ingenue. Can't we have some black ingenue?
He's the true believer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what? How do you? Did you see Black Widow?
I did.
Are you going back in the theaters?
I saw Black Widow in the theater.
You know, I didn't. I paid $30 because every time I tried to get a seat, I paid for the seat. Then somebody would sit directly next to me. And I said, come on, man. Let's like, I'm vaxxed. I'm good. But it's like, you got to sit right. Even before COVID. You got
to give me a little bit of space, right? I took my son to go see it. We went 7:40 show, Friday night, opening night, Marvel movie, right? Uh-huh. We get there at 7:18, which is wild in of itself because normally you'd be sold out.
Yeah.
And there were 224 seats remaining. There were 36 of us on opening night in the whole damn theater.
Wow. Is this like suburbs, like a place that would normally be packed?
Oh, yeah. Amherst, Massachusetts.
Okay. Yeah, that's... Mm-hmm. I love going to the movie theaters. I got one of those AMC passes where you pay like $25 a month and you get to see three a week. And it's, I don't know, like I feel safe. Like I saw that Free Guy movie. Well, what did you think of Black Widow? How did you feel about that?
Black Widow did what it was supposed to do in that it was just an entertaining romp.
Sure.
It was just suspension of disbelief out the window. Just after a while, okay, she should be dead in every scene. We good, right? Just let it be that, okay, you're going to fall from the air with no parachute, nothing, at 40,000 feet at breakneck speed, and you can still breathe. You're good. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're not going to suffocate, and you have no superpowers, and you have, I mean, okay, fine, good.
Yeah.
The disappointment of Black Widow for me was the fact that the movie clearly came out 5 years too late.
Yeah.
Clearly that movie should have come out somewhere before Infinity War.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. And so we already know she's dead. So we already know where this is going. It was problematic. I mean, that movie, you know, came out before Civil War. That was the chronology.
Oh,
that
was like, wow, okay. Yeah.
That was the area where it should have come out. Damn. And so, either right before or right after Civil War, right around there, because that's where the movie left it. Mm-hmm. And so, but I thought it was fun.
Yeah,
I thought it was entertaining. I thought it was good to be back in the movie theater.
Sure.
To be honest,
yeah.
That was good. But I also felt like that there was an opportunity there to tell a story a long time ago. And if you notice, if you go watch Age of Ultron, all the different teasers about her going into the Red Room and the ballerina stuff and all that, they had planned on making a totally different movie. None of that is in the movie.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this whole story of her becoming this master assassin, which is what you thought you were going to get, is not what you got. But it was still very entertaining and fun. I liked it.
Yeah, I think Florence Pugh stole that movie.
She was terrific.
Yeah, she was great. Do you feel confident about the other Marvel projects coming down the pike?
Well, it depends. You know, as you can see, I got my shirt.
Yeah, that's hilarious. That's a great shirt.
Right. Marvel has gone in a direction different from where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it depends on who you watch. I was a Spider-Man, Daredevil, X-Men guy, right?
Yeah.
Loved Thor as well, but mostly I was grounded on Earth, right?
Sure.
They've gone to the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby Marvel universe, which is they deal with the supernatural guys, the Watcher, Galactus, the Fantastic Four, the Celestials. All of that is different than the comics that I read. And so as they start to go further and further into that universe, it gets more and more foreign from I was a Spider-Man, Daredevil guy.
Yeah.
So I would love to see them. You know, my rule of thumb with Marvel has generally been that if I read you as a kid, I'm probably going to go see it.
Right.
So I am not the Marvel goer where the movie is the first reference. The comic books are my grounding reference. And sometimes you got to cut that loose. Mm-hmm. My boy wants to go see Ten Rings. So I'll be there. We're going to go see Ten Rings.
Yeah.
But that comic never did much for me.
Okay.
So, but I think we'll find some way to enjoy it. We always do, because I mean, Marvel brings people together, man.
It does. Yeah. I can't be too mad at it. I mean, it keeps the industry going. I mean, I'm more of an art house indie guy, and I would spend most of my time on the road trying to see a movie before my shows, and then even after my day job, I would go to the movies. I'm excited to see Candyman. That's not art house, but I can't.
Very art house. When I think art house, I think Candyman.
No, I'm just trying to think of what big time thing I'm saying. I can't think of anything.
I'm a big art house guy myself.
What have you liked, recent?
Well, coming back.
Yeah.
I hadn't been to a movie theater in 17 months or whatever it was, 18 months, but I saw Summer of Soul, which I thought was terrific.
Okay.
I thought that was really, really good. I saw Roadrunner, the Anthony Bourdain movie. I saw that last week. It was okay.
Okay.
I think those, and I saw Do the Right Thing on the big screen that was also playing at the Art House.
Oh.
Which was fantastic, because I hadn't seen that on the big screen since it came out in 89.
I got kicked out of class in college.
Yeah.
When we were studying that movie. It was a white teacher. It's a communications class. She couldn't understand why Mookie threw the garbage can
So funny you should say that.
She couldn't.
When understand. I saw that movie, I did a little social experiment in 1989. I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And the first night I saw it on 15th and Chestnut.
Mm-hmm.
Young people, lots of brothers in the movie theater. Everyone's yelling at the movie theater, yelling at the screen, of course.
Of course.
And people walked out of that movie hyped.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, Mookie. Yeah, right? Everybody mm-hmm. understood it, right? 2 days later, I went to go see it at the Roxy Screening Room up on 17th in Sansom, which is the art house, all white theater, you know, for the, yeah. I mean, not really all white, but majority white. Very much everybody there was like ancient. They were like 40, right? They were like 35, 40 years old, or however mm-hmm. old they were, which felt ancient to me as a 20-year-old.
Of course.
They walked out of that theater like it was a funeral.
Hmm.
Nobody said anything. Nobody was laughing. There was none of that youthful energy because they were like, damn, he threw a trash can through Sal's. You know, they were trying to process what they were watching. And Sal then when I saw job. It again for the first time in 30 years, anyway, on this big screen a few weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
same thing, same art house. People walked out of there like they had seen a ghost. That movie is more powerful now than it was then.
Mm-hmm. Sal gave him a job, Howard. I don't understand why he did that. That's what they, you know, that's what she couldn't understand.
That was, I was going to say that. And believe me, and I'll tell you, the first time I saw it, I was somewhat in that camp. The second time I saw it, I was like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I get why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, that's why it's so good that every time yeah. you watch that movie, you have other thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You have all kinds of thoughts. Yeah. I remember I asked my son what he thought of it. You know, he's 17 and he was like, everybody in that movie was horrible. Except the only guy who wasn't horrible in the movie was the town drunk, was Ossie Mayor? Davis. I'm like, exactly. Yeah. He was the one. And obviously Ruby Dee had a lot of pain, but she wasn't a bad person. She just was hurt.
Right. Right.
Hurt by life. And everybody mm-hmm. else, they're all just tearing each other apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny watching him watch the movie because he didn't grow up around the way like we did. So that constant ethnic, everybody in each other's face and no room to go anywhere. And it's always, you know, you're 1 minute from being all good and you're another minute from fighting each other. He was like, wow, is that, yeah. you know, that I said, that's how it was.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's how it is in certain places today still.
Yeah. 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 That's one of those. Yeah, that's a classic movie. It's he's one of the greats. One of my favorites. I mean,
no, it's a genius movie. Genius yeah. movie. And I had for the longest time felt like Malcolm X was his masterpiece. Do the Right Thing is his masterpiece. I mean, he has two masterpieces. You're yeah. allowed more than one masterpiece, but if you have to put one over the other, Do the Right Thing is his masterpiece, especially where the country has gone since.
Of course, within context of everything that's going on. Ooh, I agree with you. But I put Malcolm X on just like a higher tier.
Agreed. And especially those opening credits, the opening scene, the whole thing with Rodney King.
Yeah.
It was truly that, and that's the reason I was like, wow, this is the best work he's ever done.
Mm-hmm.
But going back and seeing where we are now. And then seeing that movie, he was so far ahead of his time. It was terrific.
He's one of those guys where he's not, he'll tell you because he said, you know, I told you guys 30 years ago,
yep.
or whenever, you know, when he was, you know, running Black Klans, when he was doing the press for that. One of those movies that nobody talks about that I really loved was Bamboozled.
Yep.
I bought that on Criterion Collection on Blu-ray and was just like marveled at how deep that was.
Yep.
Yeah. I want to that's what you've seen recently and that's what you've liked. Have you seen this, heard of this movie called 9 Days?
Nope.
It's a movie about this guy that's played by Winston Duke, who was M'Baku in
I know Winston Duke, he's in Us as well.
Yeah, so he plays this arbiter in the middle of nowhere, and it's almost like a darker version of what's the Disney movie that made everybody cry on Christmas? The piano. No, what's the piano movie? Oh my God, Chris. I'm sorry. Sorry, Howard. The movie where he was playing jazz, the dude was playing jazz.
Oh yeah. What's it called? Tina. Yeah, I never saw it.
Okay. Well, it was great. And it's basically this guy who Winston Duke plays this arbiter who decides whether these souls can be born into the earth, and they have 9 days to figure it out. And he's like a really dark man, and he's got some trauma that he hasn't dealt with, and he has these 9 souls that are embodied by these different people. It's really good. I want to close with that. You got Ricky coming up. Can you talk a little bit about that coming up in May of next year?
Just finishing up on a Ricky Henderson book. After doing The Heritage and after doing Full D, it was like, I want to do something fun.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do something enjoyable. I want to do something I can sort of dig into and really sort of have fun with. And Ricky was absolutely that in a lot of ways. Hard book to write. Big book. The real story of the book to me is essentially, here's a player who is clearly one of the top 10 players of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of his career was not very popular, and that people really didn't like him, and that he was the sort of epitome of all the different things that people didn't like about money in the game. And then at some point, he transitioned into this combination of Yogi Berra and Satchel Paige. And so everyone's got a Ricky story and Ricky in the third person. And so, you know, the book sort of tells that tale of transition.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's something else. I mean, I always look at the story of the 20th century in sports as, you know, through three waves. That the first wave was the immigrant wave, and, you know, the immigrant story, where for the Italians and the Irish and the Poles and the Jews to become American, they got into sports. And mostly it was baseball. All those first generation American, that second generation that came in, they spoke English, they played sports. They weren't from the old country. They were born in this country. The second story, that second wave is the integration story, where you get to Jackie Robinson and the game becomes integrated and sports becomes the leader in integrating large institutions where where the black people are no longer in the background. Now suddenly Jackie Robinson is there and he's present and everything changes as he goes forward. You know, but the third wave in the story is the commerce story, is the economic story, how these athletes went from being athletes to being super rich. And it's not the heroic story. It's not a story that everybody wants to talk about, because people are resentful and bitter about money, and they are upset about, you know, these guys, you know, they get paid all this money to play a kid's game and the whole thing. So when you embody that story through someone like Ricky, you're talking about these big concepts about money, but you're also talking about somebody who is a dynamic performer, that I'm not an athlete, I'm an entertainer. All of those different concepts suddenly get brought to the fore. And how do we transition along with the players? And suddenly we're now talking about strikes, and we're talking about lockouts, and we're talking about super mega million dollar contracts. And what does that do to the relationship, especially with the black player? And so Ricky was a good vehicle to talk about those ideas as well.
Was he open for your questions and everything like that?
Not really. No. Ricky was not necessarily cooperative. He was cooperative at first and then didn't really want to participate, and I respected that.
Yeah.
I think it would have been a better book with more Ricky in it, obviously, but it's an unauthorized book. He is not obligated to talk to me, so I was all right with it.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm excited to read that. I got your Henry Aaron biography that I got to read. I bought that.
Yeah.
And I got
Henry.
I bought my aunt Full Dissonance. I sent that to her.
Oh, and thank you.
And then one of my comedian actor buddies, he texted me, said, "Hey man, I was thinking about you. I forgot to text you this." And he texted me Full Dissonance, that he was reading it. He just started it. And I was like, "Well, you got to read The Heritage after." he said he put it in his.
No, I appreciate that, and obviously, I mean, The Heritage was essentially what I thought Full Dissidence was going to be. But I realized when I was starting to work on it, there was so much backstory and so much history that I didn't think people knew. It was like, this book has to change.
Yeah.
So instead of it being the, you know, what Full D turned out to be, I had to end up writing a book that had more history and more sort of more narrative story to it instead of just being a set of essays.
And I loved the Paul Robeson through line, because it was just something that, you know, I really appreciate you doing the show, and really your works provided context to a lot of my feelings, and it made me feel less alone than just being a guy that's like, that's fucking racist. Instead of just me being that guy, there's more to it than there's stuff that backs that up. So
yeah, well, there's a lot that backs it up, absolutely. Yeah. But I think the mistake that people make is they always try to treat pointing these things out as if you want something from them in return. I'm not complaining, and I'm not asking you for anything, and I don't want anything from you. However, this is the story of my life. These are the things that I see, and it's also part of yours. So you can deal with it or not deal with it, but I'm not going to avoid feeling it or talking about it.
Right. Howard Bryant, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you. And send me a galley when Ricky comes out, and I'll bug you to come back on.
There we go. Hit me up. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Howard. Appreciate you.
You got it, man. Be good.
You too.